Hey guys, we thought we would start the post-holiday on the right foot with having an interview with physical therapist Jessica Bento because we wanted to break down some, I think, major misconceptions people have when it comes to corrective exercise. Jessica will be teaching actually in February in Northern California our restoration certification. So if you guys are interested, there'll be a link in the bio here. But, you know, Jess, I wanted to start off just by, you know, helping people understand because there seems to be a lot of confusion between just starting off, you know, corrective exercise and physical therapy. Can you maybe give us some ideas of your perspective as being someone who uses both, how they sort of relate to one another, maybe where people go a little bit wrong?
Yeah, I mean, definitely understanding that they're two different things, right? But physical therapy does encompass a lot of corrective exercise. But when you're talking about corrective exercise, you're really talking about improving movement, right? So you're improving some sort of issue that's going on with movement, not really understanding exactly where that might be coming from or the cause, whereas physical therapy is really going to dive into the diagnosis and the cause of it, right? Utilizing a lot of different modalities, including corrective exercise to improve upon whatever diagnosis they found. Corrective exercise in general is really to make someone feel better and move better.
And that can be, I mean, corrective exercise can be a very powerful aspect of the program because once you sort of, you know, deal with maybe, you know, soft tissue limitations or unhealthiness or joint issues, then you want to get into the neurological control of the body. And that, do you think that's maybe a better way of for people to think about where corrective exercise fits in, where as a therapist, you have to delve into all those areas and understand how they can all be impacting how well someone can actually perform those movements, right?
Right, definitely. I mean, corrective exercise is a huge, huge part of what I do, but there's a lot that needs to go into that as well. Corrective exercise is also understanding how your body moves, what's connected, you know, what's starting to integrate it. It's not just here's an exercise that's going to help you move better. People need to understand corrective exercise is a prescription of movement, right? You need to understand why you're giving that to that particular person, what the intent is behind that, and all the components that make up that.
And, you know, unfortunately, I think what ends up happening a lot of times, because there's a lot of complexity when it comes to the body. And, you know, I think people tend to underestimate how many things go on that can impact one's ability to move. We tend to try to simplify to one thing. And even we try to give people direction. We try to prioritize like a hierarchy of things you should look for, because most people don't have the training as you do to go ahead and look at all the different variables to be, you know, considering. So with that, I think people get oversimplified. They think, you know, oh, everyone needs to do that exercise, or they need to do this exercise, and this exercise solves back pain, this solves knee pain. Could you maybe give a better sense of how people should be thinking about principles and concepts of corrective exercise rather than just focus on solely exercises?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at what is our foundation, right? So we teach the core is our foundation. You can't start doing things unless you have a solid foundation, like a building, right? That building's going to topple over if you don't have a solid foundation. So we're really going to look strongly at the core component. A lot of movements that you see us do in DBRT focus around the core or that proximal stability that we talk a lot about, right? So a low back exercise might look very similar to a shoulder exercise, but the core is the foundation. So we have to start there. And I think a lot of times people don't understand that there is a starting point. We have to address the foundation, and then we can kind of look more at the distal joints, right? When we talk about proximal stability for distal mobility. So oftentimes that will be our starting point.
And with that said, I mean, you have some people that roll their eyes when they hear the word core, and you're going to have other people that, you know, spend just all their time focusing on it. When you're talking about the core, can you maybe give us a baseline of, you know, what you're referring to and what you want to see people achieve in their exercise with it?
Yeah. And I think a lot of times when people hear core, right, they think abdominal crunches or side crunches and obliques, they just think abs, right? But in what we're teaching is that we're looking at the entire unit, right? And you'll see us talk about more than, you know, 30 plus muscles of the core. That's providing the stability of our trunk so that our extremities can move. So that can encompass lots of different muscles. It can encompass lots of different movements. It's not just going to be ab crunches. It's going to be the ability for our trunk to control that movement and create that stability. Oftentimes people don't know how to even do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think, you know, that even to the crunch point, like people also just default to planks, and planks can be very good, but, you know, you work with people that are injured, they're elderly, they're overweight, they're deconditioned, and planks really aren't possible for them. So when we show exercises, like, you know, you and I always have the discussion, like showing people exercises like our tall kneeling press outs, like people don't get what we're trying to do because they're like, is that chest exercise? That, because again, I think so many people tend to default to bodybuilding without even knowing it. They tend to want to talk about their muscles that they're training. But like, could you describe to people, like, why is a press out such an effective drill that we use, and why is it unique with what we're doing with Ultimate Sandbag?
Right. So to go back to what you said, a lot of times people really don't understand what it's like to work with people in pain. And like you said, planks aren't an option for a lot of people. As much as someone might think a plank is easy, it's not for someone in pain. It's not for someone that's an older population. It's just not appropriate. So that tall kneeling press out, what people see us often do that think it's so easy, it's really teaching them to control their trunk, right? So they're getting that ability to brace that core, which is what we're wanting and which is what you see in a plank, but they're doing it in a position that they can tolerate much better, right? So that press out is creating that tension. As they go into that press out, they're creating that core stability that we want, and they pull back in. They're in a tall kneeling position, which is challenging for a lot of people. So that position in itself is challenging to maintain, but we're also teaching them integration from the ground up, right? So we've got an active foot, we're maintaining that tall kneeling position, and then we're getting that core active through the press out.
Yeah, that's a great breakdown. And I think that leads me to thinking, like, how many people end up, you know, not really, we talk about all the time, not really understanding what we're doing with right. the implement or how we're trying to teach people to use their core. Because again, I mean, how many times have we been at programs or conferences and people use terms like squeeze your glutes, activate your core. And what people don't understand what we're doing is we're using tools to teach people how to do that. Because, you know, the example I gave, you don't walk down the street and just go, oh, you know what I should be doing is squeezing my glutes more. You know, that would right. seem silly. Or, hey, I'm going to pick this thing, my laundry up, let me squeeze my glutes more. It's the action of how we control our entire body. So can you maybe break down what people are misunderstanding when we're using tools for that feedback and why that feedback is so important? Because especially someone who's injured or going through pain or going through post rehab, they're really disconnected generally from their body, and how important it is to establish those connections once again.
So the biggest thing when it comes to corrective exercises, I think people miss the intent behind what they're doing, right? They're just going through the movements. There's no intent behind it. And they're not understanding the tool is really important. Just in my physical therapy practice, I have tons of different tools. I have tons of different modalities, and I use them with certain intent behind them, right? I just don't grab something every single time thinking it's going to do the same thing. There's a reason why I pick certain tools and why I do certain things. So a lot of times you'll see us utilize the Ultimate Sandbag, because not only do you have the load, which oftentimes gets missed if people do just body weight or bands, you've got grip engagement, which you don't get a lot of times either when we have tools, and you're giving the body feedback using that tool. That is why we're using certain tools, is that it's giving that person feedback automatically without you having to say, squeeze the glutes, engage your core, tighten up, you know, tilt your pelvis, do all these things. The tool is giving that feedback automatically, and people don't really understand that, because what we do looks so easy, or it doesn't look like we're doing much at all.
Yeah. And people don't realize until they do it how exhausting it is, especially if you do it with the right intent. And that's why I think people tend to look at, you know, our workouts and go, that looks simple, that looks easy, until they do them. And then we go to conferences and we have people run through stuff, and they're just like, oh my God, this is so much more challenging than it may have looked. And I think that's the challenging part, because on social media, with social media being such a dominant arena now where people take in information, you don't know how it feels unless you do it. And, you know, I think people are cautious. They're like, oh, this is just like something else. So, I mean, let's maybe give an example of, you know, let's say a dead bug, for, you know, when we just hold the weight above our chest, the low part of our chest above our stomach, that people, you know, often ask me, they're like, oh, can I use bands? Can I use this? Can I use that? Can you maybe like use that specific exercise as a baseline of like what we're trying to teach people when we're doing that, that looks so easy, but is actually really challenging when you do it with the right intent?
Sure. I mean, I think back to when I was first out of school, and as a clinician, I would use dead bugs all the time with no implement, right? Just lay on your back, alternate your arms and legs. Really didn't know what was supposed to be going on. And I don't think the client ever knew what they were supposed to be doing. It was just trying to like move your arm in opposites, right? They didn't really realize it was a core stability drill. And by adding in something like the ultimate sandbag, you get that load upon the body. So automatically you get some tension occurring and you have the ability to pull the bag apart, right? So we've got the grip connecting the shoulder to the trunk, and we have that ability to connect the lats, which we automatically will get that upper and lower body connection, and we'll get that tension occurring automatically just by saying, pull the bag apart. It's amazing. People get in the right pelvic position. People create that tension we're looking for. And oftentimes people will be like, oh, well, I'll just use a band, right? We've got no load. We've got no load coming upon the body. We don't have that automatic tension that you get when you feel that load that you're holding, right? So the band also, you don't have a thicker grip. You don't have the ability to get that grip with the shoulder, right? You're still grabbing the band and pulling it apart, but it's not like using something like the ultimate sandbag. And I think oftentimes people will grab a kettlebell, maybe. We've got too close of a shoulder position. It's actually not even that comfortable if you try it, and then you can't use the alternating movements, right? So oftentimes you have to really understand what that tool is doing.
And that's why I often say, you know, it's not about just having a toolbox or a bigger toolbox. It's knowing when to use the tools in the toolbox that is so important, because otherwise, I mean, again, you use a saw or a hammer, you're not going to get very far. And so it's just weird that we've devalued our tools. And physical therapy sounds like, you know, you wouldn't do that with your different modalities. You wouldn't, you know, stim versus ice, you know, or I mean, I'm just throwing something out there, but you know what I'm saying? Like you're very specific in the decisions you choose with your modalities. It's weird that in fitness, we tend to just discredit the value of the tool in the exercise and what the result we get from it. And you mentioned load. And I think people hear load and they immediately think advanced, more challenging. And I think people get this, a great example is in bird dogs, for example. Like people see bird dog drags and they're like, oh, that's more advanced than doing the bodyweight version. But they actually get that reverse, that the bag version is actually easier. Can you maybe explain why and why load is not necessarily an advancement for people, and why bodyweight can be more challenging?
Yeah, and I can go back to the dead bug when I talked about where I just had people with nothing, right? Just alternating arms and legs. They really didn't understand what they were doing, right? They didn't understand the tension that they were supposed to create. And it was hard for me to even verbalize it or give them tactile feedback, because it's difficult to really tell someone to create that core tension. Giving someone an ultimate sandbag and just getting in that position and pulling the bag apart and having that load automatically creates that tension. And then you can vary the lower extremity and upper extremity movements, you know, based on their level. But just giving them a load automatically teaches them what they're supposed to do with their body. It's giving them that feedback and allowing them to move much better than, let's say, nothing at all, right? So that's where load can come into play. And you'll often see us utilize that for many different movement patterns where we can improve upon the movement while using load.
Yeah. And so when people, I mean, they don't even have to be injured or have a history of pain. Yeah. Just, I think people generally we've even seen it with people that work out, if they've never focused on actually using load as a feedback tool, it's quite a powerful thing when you see them actually do that, right? You see big changes in both their strength and their quality of movement, right?
Huge changes. And I think that's where oftentimes people go wrong with corrective exercise. They think they cannot load someone with dysfunction. And that's, you know, you hear the line all the time, don't load dysfunction, but you need to know when to break those rules, right? You can load someone if you're teaching them how to move correctly and they end up moving correctly with that load, right? So you have to understand how you can manipulate and use tools in your favor in order to get someone to move well that doesn't normally necessarily move well without load.
If that makes sense. Yeah, it does. And I think people sort of, you know, misunderstand the concept and they get confused, because that saying that you just mentioned, don't load dysfunction, that's true, assuming the load is challenging the movement.
Yes.
But what you're saying is, you know, we're providing load to assist the movement. And so with that mindset, it's hard to argue that that isn't providing a great benefit. And so I think people have to understand body weight requires more body awareness than having something that gives you feedback, because you don't have that feedback in place. Right. So people often get the order of their progressions out of place and they wonder why they struggle or they're not getting the desired result. It's because all the time people seem to leap progressions quite often. So maybe that's a good opportunity to talk about progressions, because, you know, we see it all the time. It's not just in the corrective exercise. It's people with like clean and presses and max lunges. They go, oh, my clients are struggling. And they go, what should I do? I go, did you do the progressions? And they look at me like, you know, what am I talking about? Like I just said something in a different language. And I think people talk about progressions all the time, but they often are just using variation. Can you talk about maybe the difference between progression, just variation?
Yeah, and I think this goes back to understanding why you're doing what you're doing or what makes up a movement. I think that's even more important. And I think oftentimes people don't understand progressions or regressions and simply do variations because they don't know what makes up that movement. So if you look at something like a squat, right, you're going to need good trunk stability. You're going to need hip, ankle, knee mobility, right? Those are all the components that make
up. Unless we wedge them.
Not unless you put a 5-foot wedge in there, right? So you're looking at a squat, you need to look at a movement and see what makes up that actual movement and where that person might be lacking. That is the whole basis of corrective exercise, right? So you're trying to improve upon that movement. And if you don't know what makes up those movements, you don't know how to regress it or progress it. You're just going to do a variation, hoping that the person can do the next one, right? So progressions lead up to that full movement, right? Or the highest level of that movement pattern when you progress to a certain distance, right?
Yeah. And there's two things you really bring up there. I think the first is just the idea of, like, you mentioned major joints of the body, right? Versus I think a lot of people would say, what makes up a squat? They'll be like, your quads, your hamstrings, your glutes. Yeah. So like, why do you maybe focus on the joints rather than the individual muscles?
Again, we're training movement over muscles, right? So an individual muscle, you know, you're just not getting a quad contraction when you're doing a squat, right? There's lots of muscles working together, and you need to know which muscles work together, how they work together, and how they benefit one another. If you're just so isolated on a certain muscle, you're going to go back to bodybuilding. You're going to go back to machine weights, right? Why even do movements? So when we're talking about movements, we need to talk movements. We cannot be talking just muscles, else you're going to miss a big component.
And I think people totally misunderstand that idea, because then they think you're not training muscles, which, I mean, it's right. Going to actually the opposite. We're actually saying the opposite of what people come to that conclusion with. Is what you're saying is, you know, when your knee flexes, for example, there are so many muscles that integrate with that action that just relying on the quad makes you miss a much bigger picture of what's occurring. You don't see the co-contraction of the hamstrings or what the adductors are doing and so forth. I mean, I almost think like the saying needs to be revised, because I think people misunderstand it. Think when we say train movement, not muscles, they mean like, we're not training muscles. It should be like, we're training movement for better muscles. Maybe it should be like a better quote.
Oh yeah, movement for better muscles, trademark it.
Yeah, TM. Hey, damn it. We're not going to release this video until I trademark that. But I mean, that's why, right? Like when you talk about that, when you talk about the joints, that's in essence what you're saying, right? You're saying like, well, it's better off talking about when a joint moves, how many muscles have to be involved in that movement rather than trying to pinpoint a specific muscle that does it. And I think a great example, you wrote an article that got all this fury when you said, you know, don't get so focused on the VMO, the vastus medialis obliquus, when you're talking about knee health. Can you maybe use that as an example of like why you suggest not placing such emphasis on a singular muscle?
Yeah, I mean, look at how we move in life, right? Nothing is operating by itself. The quad is just not firing randomly, you know, doing, I mean, I don't even know how you can just utilize one muscle when you're talking about daily tasks or living or sport or anything really. So everything is working with something, right? You can't deny that when you walk, when you run, when you go pick up something off the floor, you're not using one muscle. So we shouldn't really be looking at how one muscle operates or how we can get the biggest muscle contraction from it, because it never does that in daily life. I know a lot of people will look at all the EMG studies of certain movements, right? And say, oh, it gets the biggest glute contraction ever. If you just totally, well, yeah, if you isolate a muscle, it's going to get a huge contraction, right? But never in life and sport are you just isolating one singular muscle. It needs to work along with all the other muscles. So you need to look at that bigger picture instead of just trying to look at little focused muscles here and there.
And with a few minutes left, Jess, you know, I want to go over maybe some hot topics, because you brought up some interesting ones. One is, you know, for example, you just mentioned the glute contraction. Everyone goes to hip thrusts,
yes,
for their glute workout. And then they look at us like we're got our head screwed on backwards when we don't load our hips. Can you maybe talk about like what we're really trying to achieve with the hip bridge? I like to call it a bridge than a thrust, and why we're not placing load upon our hips like everyone else in the world seems to want to do.
Yeah, it's a foundational hip hinge, right? We're not looking at it as maximal hip hinge pattern, right? We have other movements or exercises for a hip hinge to maximally load and get that full hip and knee extension where you're not getting that in a hip bridge. And in the hip bridge, we're trying to teach the body again to work together. So when we're not loading the hips, we're actually utilizing the ultimate sandbag, pulling it apart like you see in our dead bugs. We're getting that upper quarter and lower quarter connected through that overhead pull apart or lift chop variations, whatever we might do with the upper extremities, but we're getting the grip, we're getting the shoulder, we're getting the lats, we're getting the glutes, we're getting the core, we're getting that total kinetic chain, where if you just place a load on the hips and start lifting up and down, you're missing out on those connections.
And I think a response you've often gotten on your social media is, well, it's not bad to isolate. Can you talk maybe like when you would isolate and like, why don't you isolate? Even if you're, I mean, because even people in rehab, I'm sure you've run into it, want to look better. Yeah. You know, like, I think there's a misconception that you won't look good or you won't develop these muscles if you train them this way. But can you maybe talk about like where isolation does fit in and then why you still prefer not to isolate?
Yeah, I mean, I get that question a lot, you know, don't you ever isolate, you know, after surgeries or whatever? Yes, after, you know, post-op surgical, where the muscle is atrophied completely, or it doesn't know how to work again. That's where you'll try to maybe isolate some movements to try and re-educate it a little bit more. But I try to get quickly as possible to re-educating it with the view of the muscles that it works with, right? That's the whole point, is because my main goal as a physical therapist is to get someone to function better, not get their maximal VMO contraction after knee surgery. It's to get that knee functioning better with the rest of their body so they can actually perform something like walking, right? And it doesn't do that alone. So yes, I will isolate in certain instances. Most of the time, I'm really trying to get it to the point where I'm working with all the other muscles that it needs to be working with.
Yeah, and I think that's well said. And I think there's a study, you know, we'll put it back in the blog too, so people could see, like researchers even said, like, you know, during a movement, like the quads behave differently during a squat than they do a leg extension. And that's because they got to work with the contraction and the deceleration of the hamstrings and, you know, what's happening with the adductors and so forth. And so I think when people don't understand is like, we can load these muscles plenty through what we're showing you, but we can do it while also improving how you perform or move and feel. So, I mean, nothing, I think it sucks to be a bodybuilder that looks awesome, but then hurts a lot. Right. I mean, kind of seems like a counterproductive. Too,
like if I'm saying I'm re-educating that muscle, right? What am I re-educating it to do? Am I re-educating it to just contract, or am I re-educating it to run or walk or jump, right? Those are where I'm re-educating someone to do, or their post-op is to get them to a certain level. It's not to, I want that VMO to maximally contract at the highest level. And, you know, that is not a goal. It really isn't.
Well, especially if you understand, I think too, like what you're saying is the functionality, like how the knee really functions and how it's influenced by, I mean, the VMO thing was a whole knee tracking issue, but that actually was shown not to be the bigger issue of what's happening with the knees. A lot of times it's deceleration of the hamstrings, and we'll get maybe quickly into that. It's what's happening at the foot and the lower leg. It's what's happening at the hip. I mean, again, like all of a sudden we got focused on a singular muscle, and then it seemed like we got away for that for a while, and then now we're back into it. And I don't know if it's just social media being a bigger platform. I'm going to talk like an old man, but like, you know, you're getting a lot of people without a background trying to take in information. So I don't know if people are doing it because they think it helps people understand better, or they just don't know themselves, but it's like super easy to understand VMO helps my knee track, but you know, but what you're saying is far more complicated. So I don't want that. I want to know, I want the simple answer, right?
Yeah. And I was just thinking about one of my girlfriends who had knee surgery, right? And it was all these isolated movements, and her pain levels were getting so high. Like her knee didn't want to bend. It was, you know, so focused and so isolated that her body was just putting on the brakes. And I think oftentimes, especially when we're talking about like after a surgery, things like that, the body needs to work together. Isolating it, in fact, can do a little bit more harm than you think, right? Your body is just saying, no, I don't want to move, because you're just having it move one muscle. If you move all the muscles that make up that movement, your body's going to feel freer to move. And I think sometimes isolating can be the wrong choice.
And so that maybe is a great segue, and maybe a last kind of point here. And then we'll ask you one more thing after this is, you know, something else that you love to hear are there's no bad exercises, that everything is good. There's no bad way to move. You just need to move that way more. Can you maybe put some perspective upon that commentary?
There are bad exercises, especially after you've worked with so many different people that I have over the years. And I mean, even you, you've worked with so many people that are in actual pain. When you work with people in pain, certain exercises are just not appropriate. And certain exercises that even the interweb tells you that are appropriate for people with back pain or something like that, they would never be able to do in a million years, right? So you have to understand there is a tolerance people have to certain exercises, whether you're talking about someone like my mother, who's got a shoulder replacement, a spinal fusion, certain exercises like a Superman and plyometrics and things like that are not appropriate. I'm sorry, just not every exercise is going to be appropriate for someone like her, someone like you that's had 7 spinal surgeries, right? There's a lot of things that are not going to be appropriate. And I think people just think like, oh, if you move, you should be able to do all this. Your body's resilient. It's resilient up to a certain point. And you have to understand that pain is real. People cannot do certain movements without increasing a lot of their pain or their symptoms. And sometimes
I think it's a good way of putting it. Because the way analogy I like to start using now is like your car is tolerant, where if you run in the back end of someone, it may not destroy your entire car. You go full speed into a wall, it probably will total your car. That doesn't mean your car is not resilient or can't take, you know, some bumps and things along the way. But I think what you're saying is like, you know, it's funny, every sport I've ever known, and I've worked with a lot of sport coaches, have an optimal way they want people to perform different things. It doesn't mean there isn't variance in some technique, but there's generally like an optimal thing they want to do. And even if you go into things like martial arts and wrestling and gymnastics, there's an optimal way that they want to do things. And so it's weird to me that people go, well, there's no bad way of doing things, when every physical activity in the world says, well, there's an optimal. And in the sporting world, you go, well, it's not optimal, you won't perform well. But I think in everyday life, you know, you're talking about people that will get hurt. And, you know, it's not just you need to do that more. And I think what people don't understand through, again, I don't mean to pick on it, just it's an easy target, social media, is you never know if someone is surviving an exercise or if they're thriving from it. Meaning, are these people not getting hurt just because they happen to have a high tolerance for this specific movement? They're just not getting hurt, or are they actually getting better from it? And I think rarely are people getting better from it because they're just showing something new and different. They want to be controversial or interesting. And unfortunately, the audience doesn't know any different. And so they like end up just going, oh, everything is good. And we fall into this trap because it takes a lot more thoughtfulness to go, not just say this is bad because I said this is bad, but this is a problem because potentially this, and this. And that's where I really understand the body, right?
Yeah, understanding certain exercises for someone might be completely different for someone else. But just to say everyone should be doing this and everyone should get to this point is just flat out wrong.
So Jess, I mean, maybe we can wrap up everything by talking about, like, you know, what is restoration? What will you be teaching at our course? Because I know a lot of people are excited too. This is the first time you'll be leading a course, yeah. You know, got you all excited for that. just because, you know, now I freed you from your office chains. No, I'm just kidding. that you're going to be teaching. So like, what do you want people to know about this program? What do you hope they get out of this program?
I think understanding that there is so much intent behind corrective exercise and understanding the whys behind what we're doing is really important if you're going to make a difference in people's lives. I think that's what they're going to see. They might see certain things that might seem like they've seen them before, but they're going to know how to actually put intent behind that movement now and understand why they're doing what they're doing. They're going to see some of those progressions that we talked about instead of just variations. And they're really going to understand the why, like I've said.
Yeah. I mean, that's so hard for people to really appreciate, but so many times after conferences or I've done certifications, you know, people have come up to me and go, oh man, like you said, even if it was something a familiar movement, they're like, A, you made me understand why it's meaningful so much more than what I was doing before, that I was just doing it because that's what I was told you were supposed to do. Be that like, oh, I can actually see a benefit. I'm actually seeing the benefit from what we're doing. It's the first time I actually got a positive result from that movement, other because it was so frustrating in the past. You know, I gave it to people, but it was just like pulling teeth. They just weren't getting it, and I wasn't getting a result, and everyone's getting frustrated. And I think, see, you're giving direction with people. I think that's the big thing with progression is like, where do you start? Like, we hear people talking about, well, you want to find where to start people. Well, how do you do that? Like, you need to have a universal starting point and understand why that's your starting point. And then how do we make that incremental progression, just like we would in weight or in reps, but we're going to do it with movement. And I think that just empowers the coach so much more. What people understand is when you understand what you're doing, things are so much more enjoyable to do because you actually have confidence in what you're prescribing people. You're just not taking stuff and throwing it at them and you're hoping that it will work, right?
Yeah, it's easier. Like, it's just making things easier. It's just your better understanding of what you're doing, why you're doing it, how to implement it. It makes things much easier.
Well, Jess, I appreciate you taking the time to, you know, share your thoughts, your experience, and giving people some perspective, I think, on common issues that we see all over, you know, our industry. And maybe we'll do a part two, especially if people want to send us any questions at info@ultimatesandbagtraining.com. And Jessica will definitely hit up your questions. But, you know, I hope people will take an opportunity. If they can't make the course, obviously I'll put a link in the course here for you. If you can't make the course, going through Jessica's post, going through both the blog post she makes, where obviously she can go in more detail about these ideas, but also her social media, well, link that you start looking at these exercises in a different perspective. So Jess, thanks so much. And I guess we'll talk soon or something.